The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome back to the ATL Podcast. I am your host, Mappy Davis. Excited to bring you today's episode. Yes, I know it's been a couple weeks, but guess what? You can always find content. I was about to say, guess where? You can always find stuff on our Instagram at ATL Podcast. And now the YouTube channel. I almost said the YouTubes will start having a lot more content. So thanks for hanging in there with us. I really want to bring as much of the stuff as I can to you on the daily, on the weekly. And today's episode is with one Nick Love, who was recommended to me by, I can't remember off the top of my head, I probably will by the end of this episode, but we had a great chat. He came in to sit down and have a chat with me, and we actually hung out once after that and talked some. It was a great time, and we actually connected on a great, and we connected on a great level, so much so that we had coffee about a week later, talked some more. I think he's a great dude, and I hope we get to talk to him again. But we learned an awful lot. I learned an awful lot about music industry stuff from a guy who came up in it, and I hope you enjoy it. Away we go.
A family event.
Well, we'll be at a family event, and Bame will say, you know, I'll just mention something random, right? I'll be like, yeah, you know, I like cereal. Man, you know what? You should connect with the president of General Mills. He was just at this thing. And then, you know, y'all know y'all music industry folks. Y'all don't like talking to the cereal people, but the cereal people need to talk to y'all. So I happen to know him. And you're like, Bam, why do you know, you know, the GM of General Mills or Kellogg's or something? Like, where did you meet that person? Oh, well, you know, I was at this function with Matt. And right. Matt, and it's like, yo, that's impossible that you know these people. But Bame has made a life and a career off of knowing everybody from all different sectors. And I don't know anybody else like him. You know, I realize how limited I am because of my cousin, you know. Mo.
Did y'all grow up together?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Like I said, my mom and his mom are sisters. So, like, I've known Bame all my life.
Because, you know, people say my cousin.
Yeah, especially in Atlanta. Everybody's cousins, right? But, no, Bame is my real
first cousin.
My mom and his mom, his mother is the oldest sister at this point because my Trish passed away a few years ago. And my mom is the baby. So, you know, I've known Bame since I was a kid. We're only like a year and a half apart.
And you grew up in Decatur?
I grew up in Decatur. Bame grew up in the West End.
Okay, you know what I heard about Decatur?
What's that?
It's not Atlanta.
It's not Atlanta. Yeah, so, yeah. So, oh, Amaretta. Ah, to get the keeps on giving. You know, it is where it's greater, though. So, you know, it's the east side is, you know, I even got my shirt on today.
No, that's the first thing I saw, because we moved to the West End.
Okay.
2015, we were renting a spot over here, and when people say, where do you live? And I would say the West End.
Right.
And they didn't know where that was.
Really?
They thought I meant up the road.
Gotcha.
Because that's where, like, I hate saying this, West Midtown.
Oh,
right?
No, that's, yeah,
right,
that's new,
right? But where whatchamacallit is, King Plow and all that is,
they, like, think that's the West End.
When I used to say West End, okay, now that the breweries are here,
oh, that's so sad.
Now the breweries are here, it's easy. As I say West End, they go, oh yeah, oh, yeah, Monday Night brewery. Garage. Now I have a question for you.
That's okay. Insane.
I have a question for you, even though you're an East Side guy.
Right, right.
I live 2 miles that way.
Right.
When you get to my house, when you leave my house, my neighborhood, and keep going, literally right, like you can see the sign, it says East Point.
Right.
So I don't live in East Point.
You don't live in East Point.
And I don't live in the West End.
Right.
I honestly don't know where I live.
You're in no man's land, and that's okay, because Atlanta is full of those.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Atlanta's it's weird, and you have to be here to, you know, you have to be from here to truly appreciate it. And you have to have been here for a while to have seen it change into what it's become. It's really weird. Like, I see, when somebody tells me they live in the West End, the first thing I think of is the mall.
Right.
I would start at the mall and move, work my way around right. it and say, oh, okay, cool.
Right. White people, no.
That's weird. White people wouldn't go to West End Mall.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, they would never even use that as a reference point.
Right. So when I used to say I live in the West End, the first thing they would say is, I love that area. I'm doing air quotes, because they'd been to Octane or they'd been to King Plow. Octane's not there anymore. RIP Octane. And so they didn't quite understand it.
Now do that with Decatur, and you'll feel my pain growing up. When I got older and I would tell people, especially white people in particular, and they would say, oh, you're from Atlanta. Like, where in Atlanta are you from? I'm from Decatur. Oh, I love that area. And I'm like, no, not that Decatur.
Right.
That's downtown Decatur, which none of us went to growing up.
Right.
And none of the people who lived in downtown Decatur came where we stayed. So I grew up, first of all, I'm a Grady baby, a loud and proud Atlanta Grady baby. When my parents took me home from the hospital, they took me to Glenwood. So I lived on Glenwood Road in Decatur, right off 285. I lived where is now the 285 flea market and a club called Cosmopolitan. It used to be a Kmart. We grew up in the apartments right behind the Kmart, right off of Glenwood and what is essentially Snapfinger Road. We moved from there to Candler Road. I lived in Rainbow Forest off Rainbow Drive and right across the street from South DeKalb Mall. We made a little bit of money. My parents moved down to Candler Road to what is Flat Shoals. And Flakes Mill to a neighborhood called Brook Glen. And then we kind of lost our money, went back. And then we went back and forth up and down Candler Road, but never across Memorial Drive, which is what would essentially start downtown Decatur.
Right.
So when people say, oh, I love that area, I was looking at a house, I'm like, not where I'm from. There's no way.
So you never went to like Eddie's Attic as a kid?
I didn't have heard of Eddie's Attic as a kid. You know, like I grew up on the side of Decatur where everything was fried. The nicest thing in Decatur was the Red Lobster, which is still there, the Piccadilly at South DeKalb Mall, and that was really it. Those were the eating options, and sadly, well, actually, Weston Chapel now has some stuff, but like it's been like that since I was a kid, so it's weird.
So funny enough, that's the thing, is that Decatur is Atlanta. Like, Decatur's, Marietta is not Atlanta.
No, it's not.
Alpharetta
well,
is not
Metro Atlanta.
Atlanta.
You know what we've decided.
No, but I'm saying if you're going to go down that route,
right,
but
sure.
Decatur is Atlanta.
I agree. I mean, that's how I understood it to be growing up. Like, it was, when I grew up, it was the West Side, the South Side, and the East Side. We didn't even acknowledge that there was a North, right? We didn't acknowledge Marietta, Gwinnett, really even Perimeter Mall area, which is actually technically has an Atlanta address. Well, maybe not now because it's Sandy Springs and all that other stuff. But, like, we didn't even acknowledge that anything existed past Spaghetti Junction for a while, right? So I remember, you know, when we would be like, yeah, we on the East Side. Like, if you lived in Tucker, we'd be like, not y'all. Just, you know, Lithonia, Stone Mountain, Decatur, to me, was the East Side. Then as the city continued to grow, I was introduced to Conyers and Tucker and Ellenwood and, like, all of these other places. And I'm like, Clarkston. And I'm like, oh, my God. Like, and then Atlanta just grew. And that circle around what we describe as Metro Atlanta is now Woodstock and Marietta and Kennesaw and Douglasville. And it's just been interesting to just kind of watch it all. You know, I'm like, where does it stop now, right? Like, if you're in Peachtree City, are you in Atlanta still? Like, what do you think? What's Atlanta to you?
So, you know, and this has come up on the show before, and I grew up in Marietta.
Okay.
I graduated from high school in 1990.
Nice.
You did not get on MARTA.
No.
You did not go downtown.
No.
Braves game, concert.
That was it.
Was the only thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what about it? Like, when you go down there, lock your doors.
Mm-hmm.
White people, black people.
Mm-hmm.
The city did not acknowledge, like, Indian people.
No.
We had no brown people. That's what people don't understand who live here now.
Right.
I was gone for a while. When I came back and I was on, oh, man, what's that major road that runs through fucking everything?
What, Memorial Drive?
No. More like Sandy Springs area.
That runs through everything through Sandy Springs?
Like, whatever the fuck that road is. Like, you get off at 285 and just keep going. It just runs for... What is the name of that road? When you get off at 285, what used to be American Pie and all those bars? Everybody listening knows what the fuck I'm talking about.
See, that's
it's changed over the years. The punchline was there.
Okay, so you name a spot, so I, you know, all right. That's
anyhow,
not my area.
I had to go there. I was gone from like 96 to like 06, essentially. When I came back, I had to go somewhere, and there was like a Mexican restaurant, and like, or like not even a restaurant, like a fucking, like little, you know, with, you know, what do you call it? Like a bodega kind of thing.
Right.
And like the music was in Spanish and the TV was in Spanish. And that's pretty, if you live like I lived in LA, that's, you right. see that everywhere that's in normal. LA, New York, whatever. I'd never seen that in Atlanta.
I believe that.
And that, and then I learned that all these Indian folks had come for the tech stuff in Sandy Springs. And that's a, like, Atlanta was not a melting pot. It was black or white, and we did not really mix a lot.
It's still, I mean, to me, I mean, it's better for sure now, right? I think anybody who's lived here understands that it is much more of a melting pot than it ever used to be. But even when we first got that tagline of this city that's a melting pot and city too busy to hate, all this stuff, I'm like, I grew up in Atlanta where I didn't really, the only reason I even knew white people lived in Atlanta is because of the church I went to. I went to Cathedral of the Holy Spirit, which got into, with anybody who has ever Googled Cathedral of the Holy Spirit and our former pastor, Bishop Earl Polk, is one of the biggest church scandals that ever went down, like the history of the United States. We were like one of the first big mega churches. This church was on, it was Candler Road, but it's really, it was on Flatshows Parkway, but we had a white pastor, but the church was majority black. So that was how I was really introduced to white people through church, of like,
can
can I
ask you, was he white like me, or
white
or white like, you know what I mean?
No, like wasn't like no
like
cool.
Dax.
No. Yeah, I know Dax. That's my man.
Okay.
So no, he was a regular traditional white guy. I mean, but like it was weird. It was the first mega church, definitely in Atlanta for sure. This is pre New Birth. This is pre World Changers with Creflo Dollar. This was Bishop Polk had the big church. It was one of the first churches that had like, I forgot how many people we sat, but I remember we would have two services, 3,000-4,000 people per service.
What did he have that made black folks want to listen to him and not whoever?
He was inclusive. He was one of the first white pastors that was like, we can kind of do this. We can do white people, black people together. It doesn't have to separate, because they would always use, when I was growing up, they would always say the most segregated place in the South is the church. Every Sunday, Atlanta is extremely segregated. Like every, we can work together and do all the stuff, but on Sunday, white people go where they go, black people go where they go, and everybody completely separates. And he was the first, one of the first pastors that embraced interracial marriage. Embraced, you know, black people and white people, you know, worshiping together. It was a whole phenomenon in the late 80s, early 90s. That was like, who is this guy? You know, so how his story ended up panning out was flabbergasting to most people, because it was like, how did this man who started out with such a noble, on such a noble path end up in a sex scandal, and his nephew was really his son, and he had slept with the brother. It's such a wild story. You just have to Google it. I mean, it was covered on CNN, the AJC. Everybody's covered the story. And I'm like, yeah, I was a product of that church. I was in the youth choir. And that was how I actually got to see anything outside of Decatur. Our youth choir was such a big deal. We would travel. So that's how I was like, oh, the world is bigger than Candler Road.
Did you do just church stuff, or did you do contemporary songs as well?
No, we just did church stuff. Like, this was still, we were you know, anybody who's ever seen Sister Act.
Right.
Like, we were the first, I don't know if we were the first, but we were definitely one of the earlier youth choirs that was doing, like, kind of the Kirk Franklin kind of more upbeat, kind of cool church
but
music.
No, but you never said like, hey, can we throw in some Whitney Houston?
Oh, no, we didn't do that. We didn't do that back then.
Or Boyz II Men? Or
no, I mean, we evolved into that. The youth pastor, Donnie Earl, Donnie Earl Polk, who I still have a lot of respect for today. Like I said, he was my youth pastor back then. But Donnie Earl, he was the one that was like, hey, well, how about we throw some Tupac in there? You know, and it was like, for real? Okay, because he was like, that's what y'all listen to when y'all leave here, so why not incorporate it? But he was considered extremely radical at that time. Now, nowadays, everybody kind of does it. Everybody kind of incorporates that into.
Well, I think back then, Tupac would have been a reach, but like I said, Whitney or Bobby Brown, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
that would have been a little bit more.
We used to rap
tolerable.
Like, we used to have almost like my church. Let me tell you who went to my church. This is how I met people. Little Scrappy.
Okay.
Me and Scrappy met at church. Scrappy's maybe 3-4 years younger than me, but I met Scrap at church. Our youth choir director was Anthony Lockett. Anthony Lockett used to sing in Cameo.
Okay.
You know, popular 70s, 80s band. Sheree and Sherita Murphy, they are background singers for some of everybody. They've done, I could name people from, you know, here to the moon. Like, they've background sang for some of everybody. You know, I grew up with a lot of really cool people just being on the east side of town between school and church. And I saw some of everything, and I didn't know the world was bigger than that. Like I said, and the funny thing is, outside of church, I didn't see white people. There were the white people that I remember from growing up, from the time I was born to the time I was 18. I can name them because there were so few of them. You know what I'm saying? Like, our high school, I graduated from Stevenson. We were the first class out of Stevenson. I came out in 98. I went to Redan before that, which is funny because Redan was an all-white school at one point.
Right.
Which that neighborhood completely turned, and there was a majority black school.
Right.
Stevenson was built because of Redan, Lithonia, and Stone Mountain being overcrowded. So they took the kids out of those schools and stuck them in Stevenson. And majority, like, we had, our class president was white, Chad. But we remember Chad because he's the one white kid.
You know what's hilarious is that I had the opposite, right?
Really?
So I grew up in Cobb County, Wheeler High School.
Mm-hmm.
And when you say, like, oh, name the black people, Antoine, Kenyon,
yep.
Unray. I'm not kidding.
No.
Like,
that's how I can do it. I can do Elizabeth, Michael Hildebrand, Chad Little. Like, I remember them because there were so few of them.
Right.
And it was great. And it's funny. Like, I'll run into them from time to time. And their childhood and how they remember growing up is so amazing to me because they don't remember. They didn't encounter much racism. They didn't get picked on because they were the white kids. It was like, this is who we kind of looked at it like, this is who we go to school with. It was no thing when it was 100 black people and 3 white kids. But the kids that I know, do you remember the M2M program?
The what?
M2M. Atlanta used to have this thing called majority to minority, where they would bus black kids to white schools. Because if you were the majority in your school, they would take you out. Or not take you out. Your parents would sign you up under the guise of you'll have a better education. So the joke amongst Atlanta kids was they never bust the white kids to the black school. It was always busing black kids to the white school. So in DeKalb County, if you went to Southwest DeKalb or Renan or something like that, they would bus you to Tucker, Chamblee, Lakeside, and Dunwoody. Those were the 4 schools that were majority white that you could take a bus to. You'd have to get up at like 5:30 in the morning and catch this bus. And the bus would take you to school, bring you home like any other bus, but you'd have to go to school super early and you get home super late. But it was under the guise of you're going to get this better education because you were at a white school.
Right.
In North DeKalb County. And the kids that I know that went to the majority white school, they're like, I hate it. But my parents think that this is the move. You know, they think this is the way to go. So this is what I'm going to do. But it's just wild to hear the stories of the black kids that went to the white school versus the white kids that went to the black school, because they have all these amazing stories of like, remember that time we did this and we went there, and I'm like, wow, that's cool. I wish more people heard your story,
right?
Because I think that people would assume that if you're the white kid in the black school that you're getting beat up every day, or that it's so violent and it's so what you see on TV, and it's like that wasn't my daily existence. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
We had our share of fights and all that stuff. I saw it all, but it wasn't Gangster's Paradise. You know what I'm saying? Like, what's the school from that movie that right. Coolio, you know, that right. It wasn't that.
R.I.P. Coolio.
Yeah, R.I.P. Coolio. Crazy.
So when you were a senior in high school, what did you think you wanted to do with your life?
Oh, I always wanted to be in the music business from the time I was a kid.
Now, you say music business, not a singer.
Well, okay. I wanted to be an artist for sure. I sang and rapped from the time I was a kid. You know, I was the kid that my parents would say, hey, come downstairs and do the dance. You know, show your aunts how you can do the Michael Jackson moves, right? So I'd come down, put my little Michael Jackson glove on and moonwalk and do the thing. And so when I was a kid, I'll never forget this. I was in like kindergarten, maybe first grade, and they would like go around the room. Hey, so what do you want to be when you get older? And everybody was like, I want to be a policeman, fireman. I'm like, I want to be Michael Jackson. And I firmly believe that that was a thing that you could do, right? I want to be Michael Jackson. And that never really changed for me. The only reason when I was graduating, I wanted to be an artist. I grew up listening to Goody Mob, and West Coast hip hop was huge when I was in high school, right? So Snoop Dogg, Death Row, that was becoming the thing. And so Nate Dogg, rest in peace to him too. With Nate Dogg and CeeLo, I was like, wow, they can sing and curse at the same time. Like, that is right up my alley, right? I want to do that. And also my homeboy June Dog, who I don't talk about enough, but he's a guy I went to high school with. He sang behind DJ Kizzy Rock. So Kizzy Rock is a huge DJ here in Atlanta, who came up during the time that Atlanta was like mostly, or on the rap side, it was really fast, kind of booty shake, Uncle Luke style music.
Right.
Atlanta didn't always.
Miami bass, as we call it.
Yes, Miami bass, right. It didn't always sound like trap music and what we have today.
Right.
Atlanta used to be very, very fast, Miami bass, booty shaking music. And Kizzy Rock is one of the people, him and Mr. Khaled Park and people like that, DJ Taz, those guys were at the forefront of that. And a buddy of mine from high school named Julian Knox, who we call June Dog. June would sing all the hooks on Kizzy Rock songs. So he was the first person I ever met that sang and was like on the radio. And I'm like, and he's in school with us. And I'm like, wow, like somebody I know is like kind of famous.
Right.
I recognized that he wasn't Tupac or Snoop Dogg, but I also was like, he's very cool. This dude is on the radio and I know him. I can see him every day.
Well, and you have to back up to explain to folks that no one has a fucking phone that you can see anybody else.
Right.
Being on the radio is the biggest thing you can become.
Yes.
In 1994.
This is 94, 95, 96, 97, 98.
The biggest thing you can ever be is to be on your local news or the radio.
You were on the radio in Atlanta, and you know, that was like, you might as well have been Snoop Dogg.
That's what I'm saying.
You know, it was like, you're famous, you know, and I don't, it's funny because even back then, I don't recall equating fame to necessarily money. I just remember thinking, you're famous, so you're cool. You're right. Famous, so you're popular. And that was probably all that really mattered to me back then, was like, I just want to hear my voice on a song on the radio. And that'll just change my world. You know, that'll just make everything be, you know, the sun will shine every day for me.
Right. So what did you think the path was going to be?
Oh, I would just make music and just show up and be famous one day. Okay. I would just make a song and it would just be on the radio. Like, that's what we thought. We thought you make music, and one day somebody discovers you or hears your demo,
right,
and you'll be famous the next day. It wasn't until I met a man by the name of Jason McPhee, who me and my buddies, we paid to consult us on our music. We paid him, between six of us, we came up with $1,000. We paid this guy. He says, all right, cool, man. I like the music. It's really good. All right, so who's going to do your PR? Who's going to do your marketing? Who's going to do this? And who's going to handle that? And we were all looking at him like, we don't know. Like, we thought we'd just make music. We thought you was going to do it, actually. You know, we don't know. And he was like, no, that's not how this works. I'm a consultant. He said, but I tell you what, do y'all have the money to pay to do it? He was like, nope. He's like, well, then y'all going to have to do it. And so he starts handing out roles. And he was like, all right, you do this, you do that. And he came to me and he told me marketing. I had no idea what it was. And he explained it to me. And I'm like, all right, I guess. And I never looked back. From the time he assigned me that role, I started down the path of doing marketing. And that's what I do to this day.
Do you think he saw something in you, or do you think he just looked at you and said, I guess you're this guy?
Well, no, it's funny. I know exactly what happened. I think I was one of the more level-headed of my crew. And I was always personable. I always knew, because we met him a few times before we paid him. So he kind of had a feel for our personalities. But a couple of the other guys that were in my little crew, they were very like, I know this and I know that. One of them, he's the son of a very popular family here in town. I won't mention him, but
You can tell me later.
I'll tell you later. I'll tell you off mic. But he's, you know, he was more so like, well, I know everybody, and I can, you know, he was like, you know, the guy Jason, who we paid to consult us. Jason was like, well, somebody needs to take this song up to, you know, Greg Street. And my guy was like, oh, I know Greg. I'll just call him on the phone.
Right.
He's like, all right, cool. And then somebody needs to go here. Oh, I know. You know, I just know everybody. I'm this. And I knew instantly that Jason was like, I can't send you anywhere because you're going to talk your way out of everything.
Right.
And so he kind of came to me just because I was more, had more of a temperament to me. And he was like, you're going to be the one that's going to have to go talk to people on you guys' behalf, because you can kind of.
When you first said we gave this guy $1,000, I thought it might go the other way. What had you know that he wasn't just some hustler? Or did
nothing.
You just luck out?
No.
That he wasn't? Because you know people do that, like, oh, mm-hmm. I'll make your headshots. I'll mm-hmm. give you this. And they may or may not deliver a final product, but they charge you way too much for
we
it.
We 1,000% lucked out. And it's funny. The only reason we even decided to pay this particular guy was because he had an office in the studio that we were working out of. And again, to us, you work at a studio. Wow.
You may as well be Dr. Dre.
You must know something. You know what I'm saying? Like, it didn't even cross our minds that he would run off at that time.
Did your folks say anything?
My parents, no, because, you know, and I tell people this all the time. My parents were the best kind of parents for what I was trying to do. They weren't like super supportive in terms of like, yes, go rap and sing and chase your dream. But it didn't get in my way. They never discouraged me. They never told me, you should go to school, get a degree, become a doctor, lawyer, get a plan B, play it safe. They just was like, you know what? We raised you pretty well. We think you will make the right decisions. We're just going to kind of stand here and you go do what you want to do. And we trust you enough that if it doesn't work, you'll come back to what you know. And if it does work, all the best. And so they didn't question.
I hope you're listening, parents, by the way. That's a good way to be.
Oh, no, it's something I had to learn. It's something I had to learn as a parent, you know, with me having all daughters especially. But my parents, I couldn't have asked for better parents because I know so many people that are in my field or aspiring to be in my field in the music business. And all of them have, I mean, many of them say, man, my parents hate this or never wanted me to do this or they discouraged me or they stood in my way or they kicked me out the house or they cut off my, you know, cut me off from money or support because I was trying to do this and they really wanted me to go to college and become whatever. But no, I just had amazing parents and they just let me do. And like I said, and I had a, it's funny, nobody's ever asked me that. Like, how did you guys know that he wasn't going to run off? That no one's ever asked me that question. And now that I think about it, I've had so much good fortune to how I got here. Like, I've made great money, built great relationships. I've built a name for myself in this business. But a lot of it is literally because a lot of things that probably should have went wrong just worked out. You know, so I'm blessed in that regard. Like,
by the way, is this your actual name?
This is my real name. My real name is Nicholas Love.
Okay.
Nicholas Love, birth name.
Okay.
My father's name, last name is Love. My brother's, everybody's Love.
I mean, it's a great name, but it's also got that like,
yes,
like you could be a DJ name called.
Everybody does that. Since right. I was a kid, everybody's like, oh, like when I was a kid, it was I got picked at, right? It was Nick Loves the teacher, Nick Loves,
right.
You know, whatever. Then when I got older, girls were like, oh, Nick Love, okay. Yeah, you know, like, it got cool, you know? Like, you know, girls are like, oh, my last name could be Love. Like that became, it worked in my favor as an adult. But as a kid, I hated it.
Right.
Hated it as a kid. Mm-mm.
So he assigns you the marketing,
mm-hmm.
and which means, at that time, what are you doing for your little crew?
I'm just going around to DJ. I'm meeting DJs and giving them the record and trying to get them to play the song and hoping that somebody likes it and the right person hears it. You know, the goal is always still, if we get the song played tonight at, you know, Magic City, or if we get the song played at Visions or whatever club was popping at the time, if the right person hears, if Greg Street hears this song, because, you know, Greg was on the radio, he's been a legend in the city forever. If Ryan Cameron, if he hears the song, we'll be famous. We just need the right person to hear it. And that was really the goal. But as I started meeting people, I just saw a niche in regards to, I'm collecting these phone numbers, right? I'm meeting the DJ and I'm like, hey, well, give me your number, man. You know, I'll pull up on you, you know, when's your birthday? We'll show up. We'll come perform at your birthday party. Well, you know, I'm just making up shit. And I realized as other people around Atlanta were starting to do music as well that we knew, because when we started, we didn't know anybody. We were the only ones in our school that we knew of at the time doing music. So we didn't have like people to ask. And we didn't grow up with Outkast and Lil Jon wasn't our neighbor. And we didn't have friends that were already in the industry. So we was really winging it. But I realized really quickly, other people who were trying to get where we had already gotten were like, man, how do you know so-and-so? I'm like, I don't know. I just went to the club and asked them. So I became the person that people would come to and say, can you connect me with so-and-so? And I'm like, I guess. And I didn't know I could make money doing that. I just was like being helpful. I realized about a year later, like, oh, people will pay me to introduce them to DJ so-and-so or to get them a meeting with, you know, Shaka Zulu or something, you know, like.
So at what point did it stop being, or how did you make that transition? Like, you're just like, hey, let me be helpful to, hey, actually, I'm happy to help you, but if you want to work with me, these are my rates or however you do
my
it.
My girlfriend got pregnant. Who became my wife, well, ex-wife now. But we were in college. We were at Georgia State. My girl at the time, she got pregnant with my oldest daughter. And I was like, okay, I can't intern or kind of do this for free anymore. Like, I have to make some money. Now, mind you, I had a full-time job as well. My mother had got me a job at the tag office. I was working off of Holcomb Bridge in Alpharetta at the Fulton County tag office, issuing out renewal stickers and brand new license plates within the evening being in the music business. But I was like, you know, I really wanted to chase my dream in the music business, but I had to have a job. And the job of trying to get into the music business became expensive because now I'm taking the gas and running my car into the ground. It's tires, it's oil changes, it's the cash to get into a club, to buy a DJ a drink and all these things. And I'm like, I got to make some money. So that's when I started charging people like just enough to cover little bills. That was my original fee. I never had like a, you have to pay me $1,000 or $500. It was like, okay, my cell phone bill is like $120. I'll charge somebody $120 so I know at the very least I can cover this cell phone bill. All right, cool. Once I got the cell phone bill covered, all right, cool. I got this other thing that cost me whatever. And that was my, those were my original rates.
What role did you assign yourself or what title if someone said, well, what is it that you do?
Oh, well, I said marketing, but which was funny because nobody my age understood what marketing was either. You know, especially music business marketing. Nobody, Atlanta was still the wild, wild west at that point. You know, mind you, this is the late 90s, early 2000s. We had only truly been introduced to the professional music business when LaFace showed up. So we're talking about 92, 93 is when L.A. Reid and Babyface are here. And only a small handful of people worked there. Everybody else was just trying to copy a blueprint that they didn't really know. So they were kind of sketching something that they saw from afar. So everybody was trying to set up their own little LaFaces. But nobody really knew what marketing was, what promotions was, what PR was. Like, we just saw, oh, KP works at LaFace. He's an A&R. I guess I'll just do what KP does, whatever that is. You know what I'm saying? And nobody had the guts to ask KP, well, what is your job? It was just like, well, KP kind of dresses this way and he goes to this club. I'll just dress that way and go to this. Everybody was mocking the images, but not the work part of it.
Right.
So, every, you know, that's to me is, it was peak scam time in Atlanta for the music business because nobody knew anything and anybody could tell you they did anything and you'd be like, okay, cool. You know what I'm saying? Like nobody asked any questions. It was just you DJ. Cool. You do marketing. Okay. I guess, you know, and so I was able to kind of get in the door and learn on the job while getting paid. So, I mean, I caught a great window. I'm one of the you ever read the book Outliers, Malcolm Gladwell?
Yes, sir.
Outliers, to me, the original outliers were the people that worked at LaFace. Those were the people who were, if you were in Atlanta, if you were 18, 19, 20 years old, old enough to be in college, in the mix, had an interest in music, you know, you had to meet a certain level of criteria, but if you were in this space at the right time and you were the right age, you had an opportunity to work under Babyface and L.A. Reid. I missed that window by about 6 or 7 years because I was 12 in 92. You know, but I caught the second wave. So I caught the wave of people who were growing when Lil Jon was getting big, Disturbing the Peace and Ludacris was getting big. Outkast had already become Outkast. Goody Mob was already Goody Mob. And just Southern music in Atlanta in particular was growing. And I was right in the
forefront. Did you even know the concept of like, I don't know, like these guys, like I'm trying to think of like the equivalent, like Lior or any of these, like, do you have any clue, like, what you thought you might be becoming? I'm Russell Simmons, like.
No, I mean, we knew Russell. I knew Russell because that was Def Jam. I knew Lior wasn't a thought back then to me. Kevin Lyles wasn't a thought. Those names were not. Everybody knew Russell.
So that's what I'm kind of asking. Is that what you thought your path was?
Yeah.
I'm a guy that's going to work for a Russell.
Well, you know who the prototype for me was Puff.
Okay.
Puff was, you know, P. Diddy, Puff Daddy, whatever you want to call him, Sean Combs, Brother Love, whatever he is now. He was the prototype. He was the guy who was, kind of started off marketing, actually, was an image consultant for his artist, and then went on to start his own label, but he's still young and cool, and he's in the videos, and he's flashy, and he's doing all the thing. But he was younger than Russell. You know, he's younger than L.A. Reid and Babyface. He's a little cooler.
Sorry. When you say that, I can't help but think of our man Shug. Like, if you don't want your producer
right dancing in the videos.
Any artist out there want to be an artist and want to stay a star and don't want to have to worry about the executive producer trying to be all in the videos, all on the record, dancing, come to Death Row.
Yeah,
that's come to Death Row.
Yeah, the infamous Suge Knight Source Awards.
Oh my God.
Spiel. But yeah, like for us, it was like, oh man, like this dude who doesn't have the musical talent of his rappers or his singers still gets the limelight of You know, and that was foreign to anybody who would work behind the scenes. Like, oh, you don't get to be behind the scenes, but some kind of way in front of the camera. That was an anomaly. So he was the one that I think early on I was like, that. I want to have my own Bad Boy Records, whatever the Atlanta version of that would be. And so he was the model. It wasn't any of those. Lior wasn't even a thought to me until maybe Jay got big. And then I seen Jay-Z start mentioning Lior Cohen and Kevin Lyles and some of these people that were instrumental in the Def Jam, you know, Def Jam's growth. But Russell Simmons was the one,
right?
The name that stood out. L.A. Reid and Babyface were the names. You know, I grew up, you know, my parents grew up on Motown. So Berry Gordy was the thing. So there were no young, cool examples of that until Puff.
And so now, like, what year are we at for you?
For me, at that point, we're talking about 2000, 2001. 2000, 2001 is when I'm figuring things out. I ended up interning at DTP. I ended up getting paid to, well, DTP ends up paying me to kind of run out of town for them, which is how I end up, and I'll fast forward it real quick. I'm working for DTP. I'm pushing Bobby V records. This is his early Bobby V stuff. I'm doing Player Circle when Titty Boy is still, well, he's Titty Boy at that point. He's not 2 Chainz. You know, I'm doing those type of records, and I'm traveling. I got DTP to pay me because I told him I would ride.
Tell people who DTP is.
DTP is Disturbing the Peace. That's Shaka Zulu, Ludacris, Jeff Dixon.
Okay.
And I get them to pay me because I say, hey, I could run around Atlanta for y'all, but what I could really do is go out of town for you guys. Atlanta was so crowded at that point. Like, everybody was just, who was trying to get in the music business had started kind of coming to Atlanta. I didn't have the resources and still the know-how to even really get my stuff off. And I said, hey, I got family in Columbus. I can go to Columbus. It was only like a 2-hour drive. I'll drive to Columbus and I'll take the music to the Columbus DJs. And they were like, for real? Like, we'll pay you for that. Now, you, if you're going to be in Atlanta, we could do that. Really, we're just letting you do it for us. So that's an internship. If you're willing to drive to Columbus, we'll pay you. So I said, all right, cool. I'll drive to Columbus. I got family there. And then I said, okay, cool. I can also go to Macon. That's a little closer. And then Birmingham is only 2 hours away. And then I started just drawing a little 2-hour circle around Atlanta. And that's how DTP started paying me to go out of town for them. So mind you, I'm getting off work at 5:00, going home, changing clothes, and then driving out of town at night, coming back home, getting a little bit of sleep and going to work the next morning. That was how I was grinding. I meet Jeezy. Well, I meet Kinky B, who's Jeezy's partner, when they were still Young Guns Entertainment, down in Macon on one of my runs for DTP. Fab was forward. I run into Kinky B at the tag office that I'm working at in Alpharetta because they had just bought a house out in Alpharetta, and that's what they were working out of. And I, on a chance encounter, we meet, and he says, yo, I remember you from being down in Macon. Like, what you doing here? I'm like, I work here. I need some money. And he was like, well, we looking for a marketing guy. And I was like, all right, cool. Well, when y'all trying to hire? He's like, ASAP. I said, well, okay, where's your office? He's like, it's a house down the street. And I'm like, oh, God. All right, cool. You know what I'm saying? So I resigned.
So yeah. You were worried, though, when you said?
Yeah, because they weren't. Jeezy wasn't Jeezy when I met him.
Right.
Like, he was a rapper who had. Jeezy and Kink had a label that was booming in Macon and down in kind of that middle Georgia, Fort Valley, that area. They had some local success, but I knew they had some money. So I was like, okay, well, I won't be broke if I work for them, but I don't 100% know where this is going.
They at least had a house.
I mean, but the house, I mean, it's a nice house in Alpharetta too. It was a really nice house. It was like off of like Mansell Road, if I remember correctly. And nice house. And they were, you know, they were good guys. I know I had already met them before, but this wasn't a sure shot. There was no guarantee that when I quit this job at Fulton County that I was going to work for the next big label out of Atlanta. I was just like, y'all are in the music business and you'll pay me to be in the music business full time. I'm out. I had no idea how it would play out. And it played out in the best way possible for me because Jeezy became Jeezy.
What was the time frame from the time you quit that job to Jeezy becoming Jeezy?
Oh, man.
What song or year?
It was really quickly. They had just started to put out this tape called The Streets Is Watching. It was the first mixtape they did with DJ Drama. They had just dropped it. So this is like people are hearing it but not really. And I was a part of kind of getting that tape out. And that tape took off because, mind you, this is BMF era as well. This is the beginnings of BMF growing their, you know, their tentacles in Atlanta. And so everybody's starting to hear these urban legend stories of the infamous BMF nights at clubs and how much money was being spent and fights and, the drugs and the murder. Like, it's just the lore of what the Black Mafia family was at that time was like, oh, if you're around that, as dangerous as it sounds so, you know, that danger was drawing people in. So with Jeezy's music being the soundtrack to that era, oh, it didn't take long at all. We're talking about maybe 8 months to where I was like, oh, I'm in the music business.
But as somebody who apparently at that time has a level head.
Yeah, it wasn't my smartest move.
Well, I'm saying that, like, was there any part of you that was like, if you're at the club and you're like, I should probably not be here?
No, and I talk about this to my kids. I grew up dumb tough is what I tell people I am. And I'm still kind of this way, right? I grew up in a neighborhood where the older kids around me who were teaching me how to, quote unquote, become a man were like, you don't run from a fight. If it's 30 people trying to jump you, you just got to fight all 30 of them. And that's how I kind of grew up, right? So, which was ignorant. I would never tell anybody to do that, right? But that's the mentality I had. So when I would be in these crazy environments, I'm just like, I mean, I kind of have to be here. There's nothing that's going to deter me or make me be like, I should leave. Now, at the age I am now, when I sense anything that looks even a little off, I'm like, I'm going to go ahead and take off.
Right.
You know, but at 22, 23 years old, I was like, yeah, this is okay. You know, whatever happens tonight. And that's just part of being out. That's part of being out around these guys, around this environment, in this business. And I never even second guessed it. Foolishly, just never second guessed 1 minute of it. Not at all.
It's funny because, you know, as you get older, like how you even, it's like the way it works, it's not even a conscious decision about like how you, I feel like as I've gotten older, like, you know, being, it's why they say youth is wasted on the young.
Yes.
You're so young, dumb, and invincible.
Young, dumb, and invincible.
Right? That mm-hmm. It's not even about bravado. It just doesn't even occur to you that some bad shit
there you go.
Could happen.
And yes, it has nothing to do with I'm big, bad, and tough. Nothing that was going on was I'm so big, bad, and tough, no one's going to bother me. None of that was in my head. It was just, like you said, just too dumb to even know that you probably shouldn't be here. Or, hey, this could get ugly fast. You know, I've done the dumb thing where, you know, somebody pulls out a gun. And you're like, shoot me, shoot me. And you're like, again, at my older age, it's like, what a dumb thing to say. You know what I'm saying? What a stupid thing that when somebody pulls a gun on you and you say, shoot me, you ain't gonna shoot. Like, I remember saying this to somebody. And immediately, and even after I did it, and I went on my way, they didn't do anything. I'm like, see, I knew he won. You know, it's just, how stupid is that? Like, think about that.
Very.
What a dumb thing. If I was walking down the street right now, somebody put a gun on me, I'm like, hey, what do you want? Like, what, you want my wallet, my phone? Like, what is it gonna take for you to put this gun away so we can all go home? I don't want any problems. I'm not, you know what I'm saying? But at 23, it was watching too many Tupac movies and Men of Society and Boys in the Hood.
So as things get better with those guys, is it more about these guys are now going to give me more, or I want to work with more artists? Like, what was the sort of growth process?
I would have worked with them forever, but we had a series of clashes over maybe about a year, year and a half period. I had worked for them for about 4 years. And, well, I worked for them a total of maybe about 8 years. At first, but in those 8 years, we would have these clashes that made me question everything. Mainly, it made me realize that this was a job, and that was probably the best thing that ever happened to me. How I was brought into their crew and brought into the music business via them, and how I was introducing myself to everybody, because now I'm not just Nick Love, I'm Nick Love with CTE. I'm Nick Love with Jeezy. I'm Nick Love with this thing that's growing in popularity, that's becoming like one of the biggest things in the music business. And we used to, our mantra kind of around the office when we were on tour, when we were on the road, was we're family, we're family, we're family, we're family. But then when we would have clashes, and I remember feeling like, damn, for us to be family, you guys are very quick to kind of discard me when we have clashes. Just simple disagreements, little things would happen. And I remember Jeezy fired me one time over something extremely minor. I don't even like telling the story because I feel like it makes him look crazy, and that's never my intent, because I still am a fan of him as an artist, even if we disagree or differ in our theology as men. But we would do, he, you know, I remember he fired me one time, and I would be like, but we family. Like, this ain't even a thing to fire nobody about. Like, because I hadn't done anything wrong. I literally said, I don't like something. And he heard me. Like, I said it to him. He heard me. Or actually, I said it back. I said it to somebody else. They told him.
Right.
And then he came back maybe a day or two later and was like, man, I don't know. We can really trust you, man, to be around here. And I'm like, what? You know, I just remember that happening. And then maybe a week later, he was like, hey, man, you know, come on back. I was tripping. Okay, cool. You know, lost your cool for a second. No bet. And then it happened again. And then it happened again. And the third time it happened, I was like, nah, I'm going to go ahead and take off. Because this is becoming a... And I remember being extremely hurt by it, right? Because it was like, we family. I kept replaying that in my head. And then I remember, I think I was married at the time. And I remember my wife being like, but Nick, that's a job. Like, I know what it is or what y'all think it is, but y'all didn't grow up together. Y'all aren't actual blood. That's a place you work. It's like a few perks to it. It's a lot of cool things that go on around it. But y'all are not family. That is a job. And that hurt to hear because you had kind of grown in that ethos of that's what we are. But I remember feeling like after I kind of allowed that to sink in, and it took a while. It took a while once I left the last time to really pull myself together. But it's the best thing that ever happened to me because now when I deal with artists in particular, because they're all nuts, they're all crazy. Every last one. The thing that makes artists amazing and super creative is that they're crazy people. But now nothing bothers me on a personal level. I'm not personally offended when somebody disagrees with me or doesn't want to work with me or whatever. I'm like, yeah, okay, you know, cool. But I remember back then feeling like I thought we were thick as thieves, tight. Nothing will ever break this bond. And it got broken several times by them. You know what I'm saying? And I was like, oh, yeah, nah. So I look back on that time and say, like, you know, if none of those things happen, I worked for them for 30 years or until he's no longer.
So what was popular. The next move for you?
To strike out on my own because I never wanted to work for anybody again. So mind you, I got that job in 2003. I remember getting in the music business and saying one day, maybe when I'm 30 years old, I'll be the head of marketing. I got that job at 23 years old. So I left them in 2011. Officially. And it's funny because I've worked with Jeezy since then, but as a client, not me as an employee of Jeezy. So that changed the dynamic, which also made it weird between us because now when we have clashes, I'm like, hey, man, I don't work for you. You know what I'm saying? I can go deal with another client or go somewhere else. Matter of fact, you don't have to do anything. I'll walk away. That changed our respect level as well because it's like, oh, okay, gotcha. Once he realized we weren't 23 anymore, I wasn't 23, and I forgot how, you know, he's older than me, but when that employer-employee dynamic changes, and now we're essentially somewhat peers, where I'm an agency, I'm my own thing, and you hired me as that and not as a payroll deduction for you, it changed how we had to interact. And I think that was best case scenario, but yeah, I would have worked for them for forever.
So you said strike out on my own.
Yeah, I struck out on my own. I started my own business. Which was hard at first, but luckily I had a woman by the name of Wendy Day, who you may or may not have heard of. Wendy Day, she runs this thing called a Rap Coalition. She is the person who helped with like the Twista deal. She has something to do with the No Limit deals, the Cash Money deals. Like she's a white lady who is like one of the most altruistic people in hip hop. Like she's helped get people out of bad deals. She's helped negotiate these amazing deals. But it's funny because she's not a lawyer. She's just somebody who's just really new.
What's her name again?
Wendy Day. Wendy Day. She's amazing. Like and Wendy, I believe, is from Chicago, if I'm not mistaken, but don't quote me on that. I forgot where Wendy's from, but she lives here. I'm very close to her. And she, when I left, because I met her on a complete fluke because I was working with Jeezy. When I left, she was somebody who said, you know, Nick, I recognized your value while you were there. You're amazing. She was like, when I told her I left, she said, well, you know what? I got some indie clients that I'm working with. Why don't you come over here? And they can be one of your first clients. And for 6 months, she put me with this group out of Texas. I wish I could remember their name because these guys and their money helped keep me alive for like 6 months. Because there's no severance package when you leave Corporate Thugs Entertainment. You know what I'm saying? Like, that is not, the Jeezy didn't have a 401k set up for me. So when I left, I could live. It was like, you're done. No money tomorrow. And for 6 months, Wendy Day is the person that put me with these guys out of Texas. They were my first client. I learned a lot. But that 6 months or so allowed me to figure out what to do next. But if it was not for her, I'm on my face. Because at that time, I hadn't really saved anything. it really could have been over for me, except for her. Again, another good, fortunate person to have where I've met these people who have all looked out and nobody beat me. I've taken very few losses in this business, or where I just completely got fooled or somebody stole my money, or, you know, that hasn't happened to me much. So, you know, thank God.
So what's happening with 1RPM?
1RPM is a gig I just took in April. Orlando McGee, who's also an Atlanta native, who I had known in the music business for years. Orlando actually manages Organized Noise. You know, Outkast producer. He manages Justice League, who does stuff for Rick Ross. He manages 30 Rock, who did one of the biggest records of 2020 with Roddy Ricch, The Box. Orlando, he is the head of Urban and the head of Urban and the head A&R at 1RPM. And on a fluke encounter, I was actually out campaigning with a politician that was running for attorney general. I was minding my own business, had my own client, was moving around. Orlando calls me at the Blue one afternoon and says, "Hey, can you come by my office?" I'm like, "When?" He's like, "Now." And I'm like, "Well, I'm finishing up." We were actually reading to some elementary school kids. Literally, I was inside of an elementary school just reading to kids. And he calls me. He says, "Pull up at the office." I pull up at the office. He's like, I need you. He's like, "Will you take a job?" I was like, actually, what he said was, "Do you want a job?" I was like, "Not really." He's like, "Well, I figured you'd say that." He says, "Because I've wanted to hire you before, and everybody told me that you wouldn't work for anybody." And I was like, "Yeah, I haven't worked for anybody since Jeezy, and I'm holding fast to that." And he says, I got a marketing position that's open, and, you know, this is what it would look like. This is, you know, this is what you'd be doing. You'd be working right up under me. You wouldn't have to move." Because I had been offered jobs before. I had been offered jobs from major labels and everything, and all of them required me to leave. And, you know, with me, we're having kids, you know, my fiance now, but it's like, I never wanted to leave Atlanta. I've never wanted to leave Atlanta. I don't mind traveling, but I do not want to pick up and move myself and or my family to LA, New York, whatever. Every job I was offered in the last 6 years was, "Hey, we'd love to have you here. You got to move to New York."
Right.
"I'm not going." He said, "You can stay here." And I was like, "Okay." And I think he just caught me on the right day at the right time, because for whatever reason, I was super open to it. He's like, "Give me your resume." I was like, "I don't have a resume. Like, what are you talking about?" Like, again, I haven't worked for anybody or applied for a job for anybody. I didn't apply for the Jeezy job. You know what I'm saying? Like, my resume, if I really was at that time, I was like, if I were to really, my resume would say, like, Pizza Hut. You know, like, these were the tag office. And that was it. There was no, I had never done anything.
I also worked for Pizza Hut.
Really? That was my first job. Which one did you work at?
So it's a fucking car wash now on Roswell Road in Marietta.
Yeah.
And I made, I want to say $3.75 an hour, maybe $4.
I made $5.15. This was 1996, $5.15. Yeah. Yeah. Pizza Hut on Evans Mill Road in Lithonia. It was my first job.
And then I parlayed that into a Domino's driver, which began my first job of, like, the jobs I did have growing up.
Uh-huh.
Or in my 20s were always like, how can I work, but I can kind of do what I want. You really don't know what I'm doing most of the day.
There you go. You're a real rebel.
But you know what I mean? I didn't realize it, but then when I looked back, I'm like, okay, I'm in my car. You know what I mean? What am I, you know?
You're in motion.
I want to do some shit that I can, you know what I mean?
Do whatever. Yeah.
Right.
And nobody's there to stand over you.
Right.
I worked at, I left Pizza Hut. The next job was the Marshall's distribution plant. It was on Covington Highway. Or right off Covington Highway. And so we packed all the clothes that went to the different Marshall stores. And then from there, it was just a series of jobs for years that I quit in 2 weeks.
Right.
I would interview for jobs, get them, do training, quit. I remember working at UPS for a day. I remember working at Sara Lee for a day. Like, getting the job, going in there and being like, nah.
Yeah, we're
quitting at lunch or quitting at first break and just being like, yeah, I'm good on this. Like, this ain't for me. I knew it. And it's so funny. Me and my kids will be in the car sometimes and we'll just be riding down the street. I'm like, oh, I used to work there. And my kids will be like, no way. There's no way you had another job. And I'm like, this is like 30, 40, 50 jobs that I quit in days.
My wife and I always laugh. So I lived in L.A. for a while, and I remember I had to get in my car. And, like, you know, everything's a fucking hour away in L.A.
Right.
People think Atlanta's traffic is bad.
It ain't L.A.
No idea.
L.A. got 50 lanes, and they're still packed.
I had to go way out, you know, I want to say like Covina, one of those spots. Mm-hmm. And I was in my car and I called my wife. She was my like girlfriend at the time, whatever.
Right.
And I was like, honey, I don't want to do this today. She goes, bail.
There you go. That's my kind of woman.
I literally pulled off the freeway.
She was the one.
Called in sick. So we always joke like, hey, man, fucking. And I got to say, like, yes, there is something to keeping your word and blah, blah, blah. But there's also times when it's just time to fucking bail.
When you know, you know. You know, well, let me ask you this, because you sound like a person that's very similar to me. Would you advise your kids to do what you did? Quit jobs, bail?
But I do feel like it is scenario dependent.
Right.
Like some, if it's a relationship that you probably need down the line, or it's just like, I don't know, somebody that you, but if it's like some random faceless whatever, and they're going to be fine without you.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
I'm trying to get my kids are very much like my ex-wife. They're very loyal to what they do, right? So they'll come home and they say, oh, Dad, I don't want to work at this place anymore. I'm like, quit. They're like, well, you know, if I leave, then they'll this, that, and the third. I'm like, yeah, I hear you, but they'll figure it out. Well, they will. They just will.
Well, and
most companies don't close because one employee left.
Well,
so
and
I'm
you
like,
don't, and you don't. Like, you don't owe them anything.
There you go.
Like, I got a friend right now who I love dearly who might be listening to this, who knows I've been, you know, and again, it's his life, but it's like, I'm like, I would not give, if somebody offered you a job, you do not owe this other place 2 weeks. You don't owe them anything.
You don't owe them anything.
But if you want to give them a week, because it's a company that has 1,000 locations and blah, 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 and, you know, it's some fucking family friend and you're working for, like, the uncle that owns the store, and it's going to fuck him.
Right.
Give that guy 2 weeks.
For sure.
You know what I mean? Because he needs to.
But he needs to prepare.
You know what I mean? But yeah, these guys, like, literally you could quit tomorrow, but if you at least want to be a good guy, give him 1 week. He's going to ask you for two. Don't give it to him.
Right. Yeah, my ex-wife stayed at jobs long after she was ready to go. And I'm like, why don't you leave? And she would always say, well, if I leave, they're going to have to do this. They're going to have to go through all these changes.
People stay in relationships like that too.
Oh, 1,000% they do. 1,000%.
I can't leave now. Her mom has cancer. It's like, okay. And then what about after that?
Yeah, then what? Then you stand, you know, like, then
we have concert tickets together next month.
We had already made these plans a month. Yeah, no, you got to go.
Bye.
You got to go. Sometimes you got to eat the losses and be okay with, you know, hey, man. Yes, relationships are really bad that way because there's these personal entanglements, and I've done that before. Where I'm like, even now it's funny. Me and my fiance were joking the other day, and it wasn't a joke. We were kind of serious because I know there was like some serious tones to it. But it was like I was telling her. I said, you know, we've intermingled so much stuff now that it would be a little difficult to leave now, right? You know, it's like we would have to go. But in the grand scheme of things, we talking about some phone calls, right? I would have to call the credit card company, call the bank, call. It's like, I just don't want to make those 6 phone calls. You know what I'm saying? But in your mind, you think, we've got so much stuff we have to do in order to break up. It's like, no, we don't. I mean, like, the minute you're not happy, I'm not happy. We don't have to be here. This is a choice that we're making.
She doesn't have anywhere to live. Okay. Not your problem, dude.
That's not my problem.
She's an adult person, or he's an adult person.
I know more like that, actually. I know more people that are like, well, she can't afford to live on her own because she doesn't make as much money. Or nowadays, it's he. The woman makes a ton of money. The man is the one who ain't got no bread. And she's like, well, if we break up, where's he going to go? I'm like, I don't know. His mom's house. I don't. His brother, his best friend, his... I don't know.
Not here.
But yeah, not here. And that's what I would tell, you know, I'm like, that y'all can split. Everything can be undone.
What about the dogs, though?
Hey, man. <Don't>, you brought up a sore spot because we just got a new dog. And my fiance is the dog person. And we had a dog that ran away or got taken. We're still not 100% sure. But she just got a new dog.
What, you mean somebody stole your dog?
I believe somebody stole the dog.
Because they're mad at you or because it's for money?
No. I believe because it was one of those dogs. What was Poppy? Poppy was a little Frenchie. He was a French bulldog. We let him out because in our neighborhood, I live in a great neighborhood and we live in a cul-de-sac. So we would let the dog kind of run around the cul-de-sac. He always come back. So one day he doesn't come back. We believe somebody took him because none of our neighbors would do it.
Is the dog valuable?
To somebody who maybe knows. No, because the dog got fixed. So I think somebody might have took the dog thinking they would go and made him and go make little puppies and probably sell it that way. Because these dogs, she paid like $3,000 for this dog.
You know, because I watch Atlanta, I learned that those are very valuable dogs.
She paid $3,000 for this dog. She paid $3,000 for this dog.
Did you see that episode?
Yes.
I'm talking about?
Man, Atlanta's. Do you like Atlanta as a show?
Atlanta's the best show that's come out.
Do you
in the
think
last...
it's indicative of Atlanta, though? The Atlanta that you know? Because I like Atlanta.
I love the show.
I think it is indicative of the Atlanta that I'm familiar with, but I realize that especially with black people in Atlanta, they expect everything that has Atlanta attached to it to be super trapped out, super hood. And I'm like, y'all know that that's not the whole city, right? Everybody is not Little Baby and Young Thug.
But I'd say even saying that, every episode usually opens with a trap song.
For sure. Like, the music is there, but I know people that's like, I don't know anybody like Irv, like Donald Glover's character.
Earn.
And I'm like, Earn. And I'm like, you don't? To me, because I'm like, I meet Earns every day.
Right, but you're also
Paper Boys too.
You're also in that world a little bit.
Well, yeah, but it's not even just that. Like, I just realized that there were kids that I went to school with that were not hood guys, street guys, trappers. They weren't drug dealers. They wasn't aspiring gangsters. I went to school. I went to Georgia State. I went to high school. I went to church. I've met people who were not. Everybody is not Young Thug. So when you have a show called Atlanta, I feel like some people are looking for a show about that. It's like, you know what I'm saying? Like, yo, everything cannot be Trap City. You see what I'm saying? Like, no, everybody in the city is not T.I.
But that, right. I mean, I think, so for me, I can tell you what got me is I missed it the first season.
Uh-huh.
But I was on a plane, I think, when the second season was about to start.
Right.
Okay. And I'm watching the first episode where they go to jail.
Yeah, that's okay. One of the best episodes.
I had just been arrested recently. It was exactly my experience.
Right.
I was fucking laughing out loud in the plane. I don't know if you've ever done that.
Right.
Where, like, you catch yourself. You reading the message?
Yeah, I'm reading the message. I'm like, what in the world? Go ahead. I'm listening.
Where you catch yourself, like, howling. But I was dying.
That barbershop show and the jail episode. Have you seen the barbershop episode?
Bibby.
Yes.
So I know a real life Bibby, by the way.
Everybody, well, I know a lot of us.
It's
know
the guy
that
fixes
Bibby.
My phone.
Yeah,
and he started making videos, and I was like, because now he's like, I'm gonna teach you how to get rich. Here's all these seven other businesses I'm involved
that
in.
That I'm involved in.
And I showed my wife. I go, this is like real life Bibby. Mm-hmm. I've seen, I want to say the first two seasons at least twice.
Yeah.
And then the last couple years, I've only seen. Are you caught up, Dip?
Mm-hmm.
By the way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Who do you think Paperboy? What do you think his in real life, his like, what do you call it, like avatar would be? Like where he is now in the show?
In real life? Wow. That's a tough question. I don't know. Who do you think?
Well, it's like, remember when they do the, it's funny I use the word avatar, when they do that episode with the white kids,
uh-huh.
And like, they don't know who he is.
Right.
So he's already, and I think they're trying to show like how quick it goes. It
goes away. Right.
You don't have the hot record, you're fucking done.
Yeah.
It's not like 5 years, it's like 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I was saying. Who do you think is right over that, like still relevant, but like maybe the youngest kids don't know who he is?
Oh man, that's a lot of people. I mean, and it's tricky for me because I hate, like I'm in a business now where I have to be careful about who I say, right? Because it's like, I've been in conversations where I say something kind of haphazardly. And not even, because it's not meant in an insulting way, it's just literally I'm answering a question, right? And then because I'm who I am, I'll get a DM or a text. And I'm like, yo, you realize that I wasn't insulting you, right? Or I wasn't taking a shot. So it's hard for me to say, but it's fleeting. It's the music business is no different than football. Like the how people say the shortness of a football career is, the music business is the same way. If you're not hot, hot goes away fast. Hot goes away extremely fast. You can have a hot summer and be done by New Year's. And I've seen that. I've seen somebody run the summer, do birthday bash with 107.9 and biggest song in the world. And come New Year's Eve, we don't even talk about that song. And that's a 4 month run.
But why do you think in black culture specifically, I feel like it's, mm-hmm. it's because we don't really have that. Like, of course, there are people who get huge and die, right. But it's more like a 2 year window. Like you get that big album, the second album comes out, maybe it's as good, maybe it's not. But we don't, like, with y'all seem to just get over folks in a hurry.
Because black culture, hip-hop culture in particular, changes very fast, right? We're always on. I think there's a reason that black culture is considered, like, the purveyors or the influencers of cool. Because we're always trying to innovate. Everything is innovation. And we've gotten this way from years and years. And I hate to be the guy that's like, this is slavery. But, you know, like from taking scraps and turning it into soul food, from taking throwaway garments and turning them into, you know, luxury. You know, we've done these things.
From taking a beat on a soul or a disco record and making it.
And turning it into something else. So this culture has always been about How can I take something that nobody else wants, or how can I take the scraps of what somebody else had and turn it into this new thing? And so it changes, and it's constantly changing and constantly evolving. And what happens is everybody just kind of moves to the next trend where everybody's doing skinny jeans. Okay, cool. Now we're doing baggy. And now we're doing high top fades again. And now we're back to the bald heads. And now, you know, everything, the clothing changes, the music changes. And it's so hard as an artist to keep up with what's the next thing. And the one thing I will say is as you age, you want to do less and less, right? And you kind of get stuck in your way and you want to do less and less. I'm not in the clubs the way that I used to be. I don't move around the way I used to. And I tell people this all the time, especially artists, it's damn near impossible to make club music if you don't go to the club. Strip club music in particular, because that was my wheelhouse. I was in strip clubs every night because I was dealing with the DJs. So I knew everything that was happening in the Blue Flame, Magic City, Strokers, Pinups. I knew every single strip club in this city. And I was going there on a regular basis. And then I would have somebody email me, say, yo, I got this new strip club banger. And I listened to it and I'm like, what club you been to?
Right.
Because I know what the club sounds like because I was just there. And there's a certain language, there's a certain lingo, there's a certain rhythm that the club is moving in. Jeezy was great about it because Jeezy was in the club. Jeezy actually slowed music down for a while. Like, again, when we said music was upbeat, Miami bass, then we got to Lil Jon, and Lil Jon was very what we call crunk music.
Okay.
Right. And then when Jeezy came, the track slowed down because Jeezy was rapping slow. So when Jeezy came, he changed the entire tempo of the strip club. So there was a point.
Isn't
where,
like that Houston slowdown thing?
It wasn't chopped and screwed, but it was slow. So you're talking about going from, okay, if you don't give a damn, we don't give a. It went from that to, yeah, Trapadonic. Like it was that, it was slow. So if you were making Little John tempo when Jeezy was hot, you were out of touch because that was not how the club sounded. The club, you know, and now Future is, you know, the sound. Lil Baby is the sound. Young Thug, Gunna, they're the sound. So if you're making something that's out of that range, I have to question, well, when's the last time you've been to the club? Because either you, one, think that you have enough power and influence to change the tempo the way that Jeezy did, or you haven't been to the club in a while and you think that this is what the strip club sounds like, or this is what the nightclub sounds like. And I'm in touch enough to know what's going on, but I'm nowhere near in the club the way I used to. I was in the club every night, every single night, 2-3 clubs a night. I don't do that at all anymore. You know what I'm saying? I barely want to go out, you know, but.
So do you have to have your ears on the ground through like younger proteges, or are you just.
It's younger proteges, but also just continuously being in communication with artists. It's funny, like when you was asking me what I was reading the message, I'm reading the message from artists, but I purposely listen to music, not just to critique. Actually, I don't even critique anymore because I think that I'm at an age and at a point in my career where I've kind of just thrown my hands in the air and said, you know what, maybe this isn't for me. You know what I'm saying? Like some of the music that is not from a career standpoint, but more so maybe I don't know what.
Can we talk about this?
For sure.
My son, Jackson, is 13. And, you know, the way they're exposed to music, you know, you talk about like, you know, being on V103 is the best thing that can happen.
Right.
Right. And now unlimited music at any time. Right. I know you can listen to me, but it's real hard for me to focus when you're not.
Oh, sorry. Hold on.
I just got that. I got that ADD thing. No, where it's like, I'll let you do. No. Do your thing. I can edit around a silence. So my son, Jackson, he's 13 now, but since he's about 9 or 10, he's listening to Juice WRLD. Right. And I'm like, this is amazing. Right. Right. But then he plays 100 other guys that aren't Juice WRLD.
Right.
And it sounds like shit to me, and it sounds like noise to me.
Right.
And I'm thinking to myself, is this what my parents thought Run DMC sounded like?
1,000% they did.
So some of it is good?
Yeah, okay, yes. Okay, so I know what I think is good, right? I know what I think is quality music. I know what I think is like, this is solid. And I know what I think is kind of trash. But I've realized like, I have to look at numbers, I have to look at trends, and I have to listen to what younger people are saying. So there's a really popular rapper who I won't say his name, but he's huge. He's huge. I'll tell you off air. I'll tell you off mic. Huge. One of the biggest hip-hop artists. Doesn't have a song on the radio, is not a media darling, doesn't win a bunch of awards. But on YouTube, he's a phenomenon. On streaming, when it comes to DSPs, a phenomenon. I don't like much of his music at all. But I look at the numbers and I'm like, well, it can't be that bad because this guy has millions and millions and millions. And we're not talking about a flash in the pan, fly by night, one record. He puts out music at an amazing pace and they all do these incredible numbers. So I'm like, okay, this isn't for me to say this is good, bad, whack, whatever. This is for me to say, okay, this is where music is. This is where the kids' ears are. Okay, let me now use him as the barometer for what's possible, what's performing, what's underperforming, where people are. So there might be something that, like, people come in my office and play stuff that I love, and I'm like, uh-oh, that's scary. If I love it, I don't know.
Yeah. Can I, if I say the word massive genius to you, do you know what that means?
What?
So it was a Sopranos episode.
Uh-huh.
Okay, where the artist's name is Massive Genius.
Uh-huh.
And they go to Hesh, you know Sopranos,
yep,
right?
I know Sopranos.
Okay, so Hesh is like the old Jew that like made all the money off the, you know, he's basically like supposed to be one of those guys that like, you know, didn't give the guys any money.
Right.
And then they became huge. Like back then, the artists didn't get any money.
Right.
So the whole plot of the episode is that Massive Genius is like reparations. You owe us money for my uncle's song. But Christopher comes in with some fucking rock group and he plays a record.
Right.
And, you know, Christopher and his girlfriend love it.
Right.
And Hesh doesn't like it. And he says, why don't you like it? He says, because a hit is a hit and that's not a hit.
Right.
Yeah. So how much of that do you relate to? Like, you just know it or you don't?
No, I know what a hit is. I know what a hit is because a hit translates. A hit translates everywhere. I do know enough to know that this particular kid that I'm referring to, I don't think he's made a hit, personally. And that's I could look at the Billboard charts and tell you that no one else thinks he's made a hit. What I do know is millions and millions of kids are like, he is the new Tupac. And he's actually been referred as that. Like, he is the new thing in hip hop culture that the kids are like, him. He's the one. But I know he hasn't had the number one record or whatever. And I can hear it. I'm like, yeah, these aren't hits. He just is something that these kids have never seen. We've seen it. Our generation has seen Tupac. We've seen Snoop Dogg. We've seen T.I. We've seen Jeezy. We've seen Jay-Z. We've seen these street guys that come out and have a movement, sell out tours, sell records, but have hits. Number one top 10, top 20, top 40 Billboard charting records that are on the radio. My thing is always, these records are not on the radio for a reason. These things are not charting for a reason because they're not hits. They're not terrible songs. They're just not hits. But I'm like, you know what? I'm also not 19. You know, so I always sit back and say, well, these ain't hits.
But when you say hits, there's this whole other thing that like mixtape culture that a lot of white folks like even have a concept.
Yeah,
of.
Yeah,
if it's not on, I was about to say if it's not on MTV, but MTV's not a thing anymore.
Too. Right.
If it's not on whatever stations exist now, they don't even know it exists. So when you talk about a hit, isn't there stuff that's like just on the street that's a hit?
Yeah, but those aren't quote unquote hits, right? Those are just, I mean, I guess you could call them the street hits, but they're not hits. I still define a hit as what's charting, what's on, you know, Billboard to me, for what it's worth, and I know people would disagree, but Billboard to me is still the barometer. The Grammys are still the barometer. Ratings, sales are still the barometer. There are people who have made records that I love that haven't gone, you know, okay. I had a conversation on Twitter with Pastor Troy. Pastor Troy told me that No More Play in GA hadn't even gone gold. And I'm like, that's impossible. No More Play in GA, We Ready, is the rallying cry for most people who grew up in my era. It is the song for the Falcons, the Hawks, the, you know,
for
like
every high school and college football team everywhere.
How is that song not gold? So, yes, you will have those that will say, No More Play in GA, We Ready is not a hit. They would probably be right. However, I think if you live in Atlanta, we all look at that as, that's damn near the national anthem. You know what I'm saying? Like, that is the Star Spangled Banner for Atlanta people.
But I feel like like I said, not just Atlanta. I feel like if you go to TikTok right now and typed in that song, you'd see high school football teams. Yeah.
Swag Surfing is another. But okay, gotcha. Swag Surfing, though, has charted, it has sold, like, you know, it's Swag Surfing has the accomplishments of a hit record. So it's easy to say, not only is it a dance, not only is it a TikTok phenomenon, not only is it an underground thing and a song that everybody loves, it's also has performed in the way that a hit performs. But if you ask me, like I just did this on Twitter. I said, what's the biggest club song to come out of Atlanta? And I've had Swag Surfing. Actually, I didn't have Swag Surfing. I had We Ready. I had Knuck If You Buck. And I had a few other records. And everybody's like, Knuck If You Buck. And I'm like, and I had some people hit me like, Knuck If You Buck is nowhere near as big as like a Salt Shaker from Lil Jon. Lil Salt Shaker, Shake It Like a Salt Shaker. Or no, it wasn't Shake It Like a Salt. It was Get Low. Get Low is a hit record.
Legit.
It was a number one smash hit record. It's a club song. It's a strip club song. That is a hit record. Lil Jon made hit records. And I think that's where that's where the difference is. What does it do beyond your nightclub or beyond your city? Where does it go? Because this kid who I'm talking about, like I said, he's got the teenagers by their necks. He's got them. He's got them in spades. They love him.
Well, now I have to ask you this, and I know you're probably limited on time, but now I have to ask you this, because I just talked to Gip, okay?
That's one of my favorite guys.
Right. Amazing.
Amazing.
Love Gip.
Purveyor of cool. The coolest guy in Atlanta at one point.
And when I talk to him, everything is, it's all a conspiracy, bullshit, and like everything.
Right.
And like basically like he didn't play ball, they didn't play ball, so they were never going to be as big as Snoop Dogg.
Right.
That's his thought. What do you think about that? He thinks the whole game is rigged from the jump.
I can't believe that. Otherwise, I would just kind of pack it up and go home.
You say to Gip? That's what I'm saying. I know you don't believe it because you actually work in the business.
Well, it's not even that I work in the business. I'm a person, and maybe it's because of my dealings with church. Maybe it's my dealings with, the neighborhood and my parents and a combination of a lot of things. But I have to believe that we have some control over our destiny and how things play out. So if you tell me that I'm in a game that is rigged from the jump, it's almost like, well, if that's the case, what are we doing? You know what I'm saying? So that's always my attitude. When people tell me about statements like that, the game is rigged, or there's an Illuminati, or there's these, when people tell me those things, I hear it and I'm like, well, if you believe that, why are we trying? Why are we even trying if all you have to do is either get in cool with this Illuminati that's going to take care of everything, or there's nothing you can do about it because it's already set the way it's going to be set, then we should just kind of throw our hands up and just let it play out how it plays out. So I have to believe that we have some say so. And I hate that Gip feels that way because, like I said, I have nothing but high praise for Gip, for Goody Mob, for Outkast, for Organized Noise, who I think maybe Goody Mob couldn't be Snoop Dogg because the message isn't as easily digestible as what Snoop Dogg's is. Forget the politics of it and the weight of it and the deeper meanings and all of the stuff. I mean, I know that Goody Mob, for all intents and purposes, is a... Their material is much heavier than a Snoop Dogg or somebody else. But, like, I have to believe that given enough time, money, effort, energy, it could. But we are in a results-driven business, a money-driven business, and people can look at the bottom line and say, well, how much more money should we put into this project for it to get where we think it can go? Especially in the face of, well, we put out this other thing, and that other thing shot out of here. You know, why did it shoot out of there? I don't know. You know what I'm saying? I can't tell you why this thing necessarily moves faster than this thing. But what I can say is if I give you both $100 and you turn your $100 into $1 million and you turn your $100 into $100,000, I'm going to look at it and say my $100 was better spent on the thing that turned into $1 million. It may not have anything to do with quality. It might have just been the way the sun shined that day. I don't know. But I mean, I know why it plays out the way it plays, but I don't believe it's just because it's fixed. I don't believe there's a hard, fast answer of it's rigged from the beginning and there's nothing you can do about it. It is what it is. I believe you can fight the system a bit.
Did you watch the Murder, Inc. doc?
I did.
What are your thoughts?
Outside of Irv sharing way too much.
Well, Irv made it, so it's clearly going to make Irv the hero.
For sure.
Before you, how much knowledge of the whole of that whole world did you know before watching it?
I knew a fair amount. I mean, it was kind of public knowledge. Some of the stuff that they were dealing with, some of the intricacies of the street side with Supreme and all of that. Like, I'm not from New York, but I mean, I traveled to New York enough to kind of understand who the players were and what it was. I knew 50 and I knew their clashes and the whole nine.
Were you interacting with that world at all at that time?
No, because I was in Atlanta very much figuring it out in Atlanta. Those were things that were happening they were happening at the same simultaneously, but I was here doing my thing. New York was a world away to me at that point. I was here when 50 Cent dropped Get Rich or Die Trying. I was in Atlanta All-Star Weekend, or might have been Super. I think it was All-Star Weekend. And I remember being like, this is the business I want to be in. Because he took, this New York guy had dropped this music that was taking over Atlanta. And, you know, for an entire weekend, that's all I heard out of everybody's cars was 50 Cent. So I knew the phenomenon that he was. I knew what Ja was previous to him dropping. I knew who Supreme was because there were a lot of New Yorkers that had moved down here. So I'd heard all the stories. I think with Murder, Inc., I think what you saw was what can potentially, how potentially mangled and twisted and intertwined these worlds can be, and how that doesn't always play out in the best way. And I heard, you know, and ironically, I would hear that years later with Jeezy. People, and I always took it as disrespect to me and the people who worked with me in our jobs. When people would say, I mean, Jeezy, cool, but I mean, all you got to have is some money and some street cred and you could do it too. And it's like, no, there were other factors, mainly me, Coach K, Asha, Ace, Kink, everybody who was around at that time, the DJs that went into him moving. It wasn't just street cred and money, because there were other rappers around that same time that had the same exact street cred and the same access to the money and didn't pop. So if all you needed was just money and some gangsters around, why didn't everybody who had that pop? And it doesn't always play out the way where the artist becomes Jeezy. The artist doesn't always become, you know, a star. Sometimes they go to jail. Sometimes they die. Sometimes they get indicted. Sometimes, and as we're seeing now, when you start intermingling all the street stuff and the music, yeah, it adds to the lore and the illusion and the draw, but it doesn't always play out where the artist becomes thing.
As they pointed out, there's a point, whatever it was, a year, where he literally had like the number one song.
Mm-hmm.
Like between three different artists, like 16 weeks, 18 weeks,
mm-hmm.
which would never happen now for a lot of reasons.
For a lot of reasons.
But what is that something like you would like aspire to? Like what, or what can I learn from that? What did those guys do to make that happen?
Well, like you said, I don't think you can duplicate some of the things, the records that were broken or set back in those days. I think it's going to be tough to duplicate because the times are different. The people are different. The fans are different. How you get music is different. It's even like the video star, right? You know, I was telling the artist the other day, they were talking about spending, it wasn't even a whole, I mean, relatively, it was like maybe 10 grand they want to spend on a video. And in my mind, you know, there were days where people paid $1 million for a Hype Williams music video. He was doing Busta Rhymes and Missy Elliott and all these big video Puff. And now I'm like, 10 grand, man, you crazy? Because when you make a video nowadays, where are people going to see it?
YouTube.
Yeah, there's no more 106 and Park. There's no more TRL. There's no more MTV that's running the videos all day long. There's no more BET that's running video. There's no Video Soul. There's no, those days are gone. So why would you put so much money into a thing that has to be placed in a medium that no longer consumes everybody's attention? You'd be better served. All the attention is on TikTok, unfortunately, for better or for worse, or what people want to say. TikTok has the world's attention at this point.
So you would tell any artist, put your shit there?
Yeah, because you want to, I mean, you listen to Gary Vee at all? Some people hate him, some people love him.
I was on the Gary Vee train until very recently.
Okay, same. I was on him, same. The pandemic, I slowed down off Gary, not because he did anything in particular. I just was like, I'd heard these messages before and I kind of moved on. But one thing he's always said that I agree with is that you go where the attention is.
Go where the attention is.
And if the attention is in TikTok, and he's also like, don't be loyal to a platform. Like the minute the attention is not at TikTok, move. You know what I'm saying? Like just go. So if everybody's on TikTok right now, you're better served placing your music, your videos, your content on TikTok. But they're also on YouTube. They are on Instagram still. Twitter is having a massive resurgence. But you go where the attention is. So if you know that the attention is over here, you're better served time and money wise having short form content than you are having a 3-4 minute video per se, unless that video is one of those, and you know, if you got one of them. Like I knew when Cardi B and Megan dropped that the wet ass pussy record, right? I was like, oh, I mean, you gotta put a video out for that, right? Like everybody's gonna tune in to just see what it is.
So let me get back to that thing, though. So what do you think could be can be learned from those guys? Again, forget the era. Just right. What were those guys doing right that
they were making hit records? Irv made hit records. Irv crafted and had an ear for and knew how to find talent. Irv is one of the will go down. He'll go down as a guy who ran Murder, Inc., but what he should go down is one of the best A&Rs that ever lived. He found Jay, DMX, Ja Rule, Ashanti. He made hit records. He produced hit records. He had an ear that he knew what a hit was. I don't think anybody in the music business, especially on the urban side, could ever question Irv Gotti's ear. He knew a hit record. He knew how to get a hit record. He knew how to keep tweaking a record until it was like, this is the one. I know this can go. It has all the elements of a hit. And to me, that is Irv's greatest contribution to the music business. He showed people, like, I can take this thing that growls on the microphone and barks like a dog and craft it in a way that you'll be like, yeah, this is it. You know, he made records, and DMX is not a conventional star. The popularity and the legend of DMX is completely against the grain of anything you've seen. Girls may argue about what it is, but he wasn't your traditional looker. You know what I'm saying? This wasn't, you know, what they looked at Elvis and James Dean and people, you know, from that day and age. And he wasn't Usher.
Right.
He wasn't, you know, even T.I. had DMX was not that. He was very much rough around the edges, but Irv figured out how to make that work. And was so good of an A&R, that wasn't even his artist. He found him, and then DMX went on and did his own thing, and Irv was still somehow involved. Like, Irv, that dude was amazing. And turned around and did it with a similar-sounding artist with Ja, you know? So it's what he's been able to do is, I think that's what you take from it. You look at Irv and say, how can I duplicate the hit records? Or how can I duplicate the process of making the hit records? I think that's what's been lost in this quick, fast, kind of microwavable generation of music where everything is quick and TikTok and 30-second videos, 15-second Instagram reels, stuff like that. It is, how can I do it? How can I mass produce records? Not so much, where can I find a hit? And DJ Khaled said it a few years ago, like right when he was kind of getting, it's right around the time when he got lost on that speed, not the speedboat, the jet ski. And that was that TikTok that he was on? He was on Snapchat,
right,
when he was doing it. And he was like, you know, in the absence of a hit, we'll start calling anything a hit because we haven't heard one. And I thought that was so profound for Khaled, of all people, to say that, because he's like, y'all keep telling me that there's a bunch of hit records out, but what's the hit? Like, he's looking around the same thing I'm looking at. He's looking at charts and saying, that wasn't a hit record. Y'all liked that record. It was a good record, but that wasn't a hit. And then Khaled would say, let me show y'all a hit. And then Khaled would put out something, and you're like, okay, there is a difference between what Khaled just did and what so-and-so just did. I don't know if Khaled is losing that touch, because Khaled's amazing, but I haven't loved the most recent releases as I did the early stuff. But there is a difference between a hit and just some record you like. And I think Khaled is from that school. I think Jermaine Dupri is from that school. Pharrell is from that school of finding hits. And that's what we need more of in the music business, especially on the hip-hop side.
All right. I always like to wrap up with the Atlanta Favorites Quiz.
Okay.
There are no wrong answers.
Okay.
First question, what is your go-to order at Waffle House?
My go-to order is to avoid Waffle House at all costs. I hate Waffle House. It's a terrible place. I've named it Awful House, and I coined that phrase. It's a terrible place. I don't know why anybody eats there, and it should be stayed far, far away from.
That's the first time I've gotten that answer.
Don't like it at all.
What is your current favorite place to eat in Atlanta?
Okay, in Atlanta, or just in, are we calling it Metro Atlanta or in Atlanta? Or like Atlanta? OTP or ITP?
I'll give you one of each. How about that?
Okay. OTP might be, well, you know, I just discovered Parker's on Ponce. It's a restaurant in downtown Decatur. It's like a steakhouse. It's like super dope. But my original answer would have been Capers. It's a spot off of Barrett Parkway up in Kennesaw. It's a black owned restaurant. It's on a public shopping plaza. You would never know that it's as nice as it is, but it's amazing. But it's like fine dining, but it's up in Kennesaw in a public shopping plaza. So if you ever get a chance and you're up in Barrett Parkway near Town Center Mall, drive a mile down the street. Capers, it's amazing. Inside the perimeter, I would tell you that my favorite place to eat right now, you know what? I can never go wrong going to Antico and Gio's Chicken and Tropical, that little block right off of Hempfield, 14th Northside Drive area, I can guarantee you I will find something I like in one of those spots. So shouts out to Gianni.
Finish the sentence. I take MARTA blank.
As little as possible. Atlanta is one of those cities where, like, you know, New York with the subway, it's like rich, poor, whatever, you're gonna take the subway. This is part of life. Atlanta, you aspire to make enough money where you don't have to take MARTA. If I'm taking MARTA, I'm probably going to a game or a concert. But I take MARTA literally only to Falcons games, Hawks games, or some special event that I just don't want to deal with the parking. Yeah, that's it.
Publix or Kroger?
Publix, easily.
Outkast or Goody Mob?
Goody Mob. I believe Goody Mob still standing and Soul Food stand the test of time. And I also believe that CeeLo is better than Andre 3000, which is a great barbershop discussion to have, but I'm a CeeLo Green fan.
That we will have the debate perhaps next time.
And Andre is amazing, by the way, but I just think CeeLo is just out of here.
Tassili's or Soul Veg?
Oh, neither, but if I had to choose Tassili's. I don't like the vegan thing.
We just talked about trying to eat healthy.
Yeah, but I haven't gotten that far in my dietary. I ain't there yet.
Okay.
And somebody really, really, my shout out to my guy DJ Kerosene. He took me to Soul Veg one time and we sat there and I tried my best to like truly, truly enjoy it. And I couldn't.
What is the best concert you have seen in Atlanta?
Ooh, one music fest, the Dungeon Family reunion. Best thing I've ever seen in my life to see all of them on stage at the same time. Second best would probably be the Bad Boy reunion when Puff came to town a few years back when he had Jodeci and everybody from that era on stage with him.
All right, the final question is, who should I have next on the ATL podcast?
Have you done Chili O?
He's actually, I think we already picked a date.
Okay, cool. So Chili O, if you haven't done him, so who else would be good? You've already done my cousin Bane. Have you done, who is somebody that I, Reese LaFlair. Have you ever met Reese LaFlair?
I have not.
Reese LaFlair is, he's one of the trendsetters in hip hop culture here in Atlanta. He's a name that people don't speak on enough. But musically, he's very talented. But he, fashion-wise, is where he really stands out. So he is actually credited with like a lot of like Wiz Khalifa's aesthetic. He got it from Reese. A lot of rappers have taken stuff that Reese was doing because he's a skateboarder as well. So a lot of his fashion, a lot of his kind of aesthetic of how he moves and how he kicks it, a lot of rappers come to him to kind of peep what he has going on, even if they're not directly asking him what to wear.
Right.
They're like, they'll watch him like, oh, okay. Like Reese is the one with the, when everybody was doing the big chains, Reese was the one that started bringing back like the chokers and the smaller chains. When everybody was doing, you know, baggy pants, he was one of the first to slim it up. He was the first one to start wearing fatigue shorts and cargo. Like Reese was doing that as this kid who, I can't even tell you how he got to be this influential or why people even cared what he was doing. But a lot of rappers have taken their swag and kind of how they move from Reese. So he'd be excellent to interview because he can tell you a lot about young hip hop counterculture in Atlanta. He's this, like I said, he's the skateboard kid when skateboarding wasn't cool. He was that. So Reese would be amazing if you can get him, and I don't know, you had Gip. Gip is one of my favorite people in the world. That's, I don't know. I'm sure it's somebody else, but Reese would be dope.
All right, let's make that happen.
Yeah.
Tell people where they can find what you're up to now.
I post everything on social media for better or for worse. So if you can find me on everything at Nick Love ATL, NICKLOVEATL. That's me. Twitter, Instagram, TikTok.
Do you want to pimp one RPM or anything?
If you're an artist and you are looking for digital distribution, you don't have to go anywhere else. 1RPM is here. We have an office here. And the best thing I can say about 1RPM, on top of all the many things that we offer, is that 1RPM, there are people in the office. Like, you know, if you've ever done digital distribution, you know that if there's an issue, which there inevitably will, because we're dealing with a bunch of technology, you'll put your song online. And it'll show up everywhere except Pandora, or something will be spelled wrong. It'll be some random glitch, And then your only recourse is to go to info at whatever and send them an email.
And hope they get back to you.
And hope they get back to you. That is your only recourse. And sometimes they'll take 48 hours, respond with some automated message that doesn't answer your question. And now you have to wait again.
The fucking worst.
Yeah. So at least with 1RPM, we are here. You can pull up on us. The office is off of Joseph Lowry, kind of like Joseph Lowry and Marietta Boulevard, right in the King Plow, Puritan Mills area. We're right there. And so you can always pull up on us and ask us a million questions. If I'm not here doing an interview, I will be at the office, which is where I'm headed to in just a second because my phone is blowing up and everybody's like, hey, where you at?
All right, thanks, so I'm on the way there. Thanks for staying over here, man.
Hey, thank you for having me.
There you have it. That was Nick Love. Remember, you can find us now on Instagram and YouTube all the time. Go ahead and hit the links there while you're listening to this app. And also drop me a note. Let me know how you found the show, either right there on Instagram or drop me a note, mattbdavis@icloud.com. I would love to hear from you just to say, hey, Matt, enjoying the show. This is the episode I found, and these are the ones I'm enjoying, or here's what I think you should have on. Always up for finding great, great Atlanta guests. I have got a ton in the can for you guys. There are a whole bunch of episodes coming, including the man I just met. I am Say So. Sorry, it's the end of a long day. You're going to know by the time you hear it. And Lola Cash, who I also found on Instagram. Some great Atlanta folks bringing you cool Atlanta stuff. Much, much more to come. Love you. Miss you. Mean it. I've got to run.